Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. I am your host, Dr. Mick Krasner, and this podcast is being produced by MPRO with over 35 years of experience as a regional medical professional liability insurance carrier headquartered in New York State. MPRO has been dedicated to protecting New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania's physicians, healthcare facilities, and healthcare providers. MPRO has also led the industry in peer support activities, and this podcast is yet another way in which MPRO is supporting the needs of physicians. The goal of this podcast is to explore ways that we as health professionals, physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, mental health providers, therapists, and others can truly flourish in the complex and challenging world of healthcare. This is our second podcast, and I'm very excited to share with you an interview with a colleague whom I know very well. He is a leader and a transformational force in helping physicians and other health professionals flourish. Ron Epstein is an internationally recognized physician, educator, researcher, and writer. He has published groundbreaking research into communication in medical settings and develop innovative educational programs that promote mindfulness, communication, and self-awareness. His over 300 scholarly articles and his book, Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity, is the first book about mindfulness and medical practice written for patients, their families, and for doctors and other health-providing caregivers. It is a groundbreaking, intimate exploration of how doctors approach their work with patients. In this book, Ron describes how health professionals can flourish, build strong connections with patients and colleagues, optimize the care they provide, and become more resilient. Dr. Epstein co-directs the Center for Communication and Disparities Research, and with me, he co-directs Mindful Practice and Medicine programs at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He's a professor of family medicine, oncology, and medicine, a graduate of Wesleyan University and Harvard Medical School, and the recipient of numerous Lifetime Achievement Awards relating to communication and humanism, a Fulbright Fellowship in Barcelona, fellowships at the University of Sydney and the Brosher Foundation in Geneva, and the American Cancer Society's highest award, the Clinical Research Professorship. And now, our conversation with Dr. Ronald Epstein. What I'd like to do is begin with a question that I'm going to strive to ask all of our guests. It comes out of my experience and a lot of our experiences with other health professionals as we begin to dig a little deeper into why they decided to go in the health professions. We often hear pretty profound, sometimes poignant stories, narratives about their proximity to illness, to suffering, to life events like that, and how those have impacted them, sometimes at a very, very early age. Sometimes it's not suffering, but it may be an encounter in the healthcare system that, you know, that did something emotionally, cognitively, physically to oneself. So I'd like you to just tell us a little bit about, we could call this our origin story in medicine. You know, what is your origin story? Why did you, among all your many talents, and you have so many, why medicine? Why did this happen? What happened early in your life that has informed that in a profound and lasting way?
Yeah, well, thank you. How many hours do you have? I mean, if you want to go way back, as a child, I was quite sickly. Nothing serious, but things enough to keep me at home a lot. And to see doctors pretty frequently. I had asthma, I had recurrent ear infections. And it really actually did have an impact on my life, which I didn't realize until subsequently. I couldn't run when I was a child without coughing or getting out of breath, for example. And I remember, really from a very young age, from when I was five or six, the kindness of physicians, that how much that mattered. And just even, not even with the words that they said, because I probably didn't understand a lot of the words, but but their sense of presence, the way that they touched me, the way that they looked at me, and that really had a profound influence. And then my health improved when I was about 9 or 10 or 11, but in the process, I became very interested in how people get sick and what happens, and would read encyclopedia entries about illness. And it wasn't kind of in a morbid way. It was a really curious way about how do people live their lives when they're compromised in some way. And we all are. The other thing that I discovered with my asthma at quite a young age, I must have been 7 or 8, is that if I could lie down very still and breathe shallowly, so kind of be really aware of my breathing, that it would make, it initially was difficult to do, but then eventually I realized that I wouldn't be coughing and I wouldn't be feeling short of breath. So there was some sense of control that I felt that I had over the illness. And now this was the early 1960s, so the treatments for asthma were terrible. There were no inhalers, there were, you know, just these drugs that made you jittery. And, you know, now it would be very different. But in those days, so that ability to be involved in my own care and to, you know, heal myself in a certain way, I think was also pretty fundamental. So that's kind of the early stuff. And then I was kind of vacillating between being a musician and being a physician. I mean, ultimately, I decided to be both, but, you know, which to put forward and which to make my living at. But in my process of getting interested in healing, it was kind of a circuitous route that kind of took me through Zen training to understanding the kind of Oriental medicine, Chinese medicine theory and practice. I studied shiatsu and acupuncture and then had this delusional belief that if I really wanted to be a healer, I should go to medical school. I don't know. I mean, just kind of a, you know, tongue in cheek, but in medical school itself, I didn't find much about healing. I found a lot about diseases and curing and protocols and techniques. But I didn't find a lot about healing. So felt I was still kind of on my own to discover that and how to synthesize my own personal experiences and my experiences with Buddhism and with Chinese medicine and Western medicine. And that took a while. That took a while after I finished medical school. Probably, I think it was kind of a 10-year trajectory for me. So that's kind of the beginnings.
Okay. Yeah. You know, in that beginning story that is still active now, you talk about presence. Describing that experience as a young asthmatic and that sense of presence and kindness, which may be a surrogate word or a qualifier, an adjective to go along with presence. And I'll just jump right to your landmark article in 1999 in JAMA called Mindful Practice, in which you outlined these qualities of the exemplary clinicians that came out of your own experience, your own observations, attentive observation, beginner's mind, critical curiosity, and presence. Can you just speak a little bit more about presence? And you can include aspects of those other qualities, and especially maybe the examples of times and moments that you've felt it very, very palpable in your own work as a physician, but also as a patient, and also times in which it hasn't been there that's, you know, kind of in some ways motivated you to include this in the canon of what you teach.
I think presence is always present, but it comes in different flavors. So there's the, you know, kind of sense of resonance and deep connection with individuals. And that happens some of the time. And it's really delicious when that happens. It's something to savor. And sometimes it can happen in a moment of silence. Sometimes it can happen when each of us feels that we've been seen and understood. But it's something that is not embodied in me as a person, and it's not embodied in the other person, but it somehow occupies the space between us. And so I call that shared mind, that sense. It's not that you agree on everything or see the world in the same way, but you have this capacity to experience the other and feel experienced by the other. So it's kind of this mutual process. But there are times when, you know, I feel misunderstood and patients feel misunderstood, and that connection doesn't feel quite that exquisite. And that second kind of presence is a moving toward. It's not always delicious, but it's recognizing that there is a gap or a gulf, and it can be because of, you know, life experience. It can be because of culture. It could be because of any number of things. But I think that presence, that intention to move toward another, is another kind of presence that we have to cultivate, and often cultivate very quickly in our practice. I'm just thinking about, you know, after this interview, I'm going to be talking with an emergency room physician who's a mentee. And you know, in the emergency room, you have to establish that moving towards very quickly. I mean, you only have a very short amount of time, and you know that your relationship is very time limited. So that's a second kind. And then I think it comes in words, but also in physicality to it. And often I feel the greatest sense of presence when I'm touching a patient, when I'm examining them, and even procedures, even injecting a arthritic shoulder with a steroid, I can feel this sense of presence. It's kind of a bodily experience. It's not just an emotional experience. It has a real physicality to it. And so I think, you know, now I'm just really exploring those different flavors of presence and trying to, you know, understand what each one is like.
What happens to you when you are really experiencing that as a clinician, as a physician, health professional? How does that change the quality of your own experience of work?
Yeah, I think it's really integral to my identity as a healer. So I feel that I have this sense of, yes, this is the right place to be. This is the right thing to be doing. You know, it's the right vocation. It's the right action. It's just, there's something very resonant about it.
You feel very aligned, in alignment, one could say?
Attuned, aligned. You know, when you're walking with someone and you have the same gait without even knowing it, you know, you're stepping in sync with someone else. So there's that sense of connection.
So connecting that presence with those other qualities, attentive observation, critical curiosity, beginner's mind, and, you know, part of your life's work, especially more recently, has been to help others, help your colleagues cultivate those already inherent abilities that they have as human beings, and especially as trained health professionals. And this podcast is called Flourishing in Medicine, something that you've written about, something that you've studied, something that you're very interested in promoting. And maybe you can help us and help our listeners understand, what does that mean, even flourishing? Can you define what flourishing in medicine looks like, and maybe a little bit of contrast with what it doesn't look like?
Yeah. I think that for me, when I feel that I'm flourishing, I'm able to get a perspective on the things that are unpleasant about my work and put them in their place. I mean, we all know all of the drivers of burnout and distress and moral distress in medicine. And when I feel that I'm flourishing, I know all of that. I know that medicine's difficult and that health systems are broken and all of that. And at the same time, I feel like I'm doing the work that is giving something important to the world and also providing a sense of meaning for myself. So it's kind of the opposite of denying that there's distress or denying that there's joy. There's both. It's kind of taking in the whole picture, the beautiful and the ugly at the same time. I'm a great fan of Walt Whitman's poetry, and one thing that I like about it, I mean, there are all sorts of things, but first of all, it's sensual. And I think that medicine is a highly sensual profession. We're using all of our senses all of the time. The second is that it's full of contradiction. Things are going well and they're going terribly, often at the same time. That people are suffering and they're healing at the same time. So taking in these opposites without needing to erase one or the other. So it's almost kind of an electric, kind of a buzz feeling that I get when I'm in that state of, I guess it's kind of radical acceptance of the way the world is, but that's what drives my passion to make the world better. I don't know if that makes sense to you. So without the acceptance, there wouldn't be the drive. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was beautiful and everything was horrible, or everything was horrible, but it's that tension, it's that dynamic tension that that provides the engine for me.
And, you know, maybe this goes back to your origin story. How is it that you have felt yourself drawn to be right in the middle of that dynamic tension? And maybe a better question is, why does being in the middle of the dynamic tension, if it does, give you such sense of meaning and joy in your work?
Well, as you know, I was in primary care for 35 years or so. And also for the past, 17 years, I've done palliative care in the hospital, in a tertiary care hospital. And I mean, they call me in not for ordinary situations. Usually it's when families need to make really difficult decisions about their loved one, and they're kind of at each other's throats because they disagree and there's a lot of tension in the room. And I actually find this really energizing because it's not a problem that can be solved, right? These are not problems that logic can solve. They're problems that you can grow through. And if I feel that I'm growing through those problems with a family, with a contentious situation, then, and I can see growth in others, for me, that's really energizing. And so I see my job as not fixing things, but my job is helping people grow. It's kind of the difference between being a mechanic and being a gardener. And mechanics fix things because machines usually don't fix themselves. But gardeners, you can't fix a plant. You know, you can't make a plant grow. You can provide the conditions under which they grow. And so we need both of that in medicine. We need kind of the mechanic part and the gardener part. I kind of feel like the mechanic part, I enjoy to a certain degree, but I also feel that that's not the thing that energizes me as much as the gardener part.
Yeah, I'm thinking about life, a statement, life is not a problem to be solved. It's something to be lived, to live within. And yet, on the other hand, our training in some ways, it's difficult to include that uncertainty and chaos and all the problems that cannot be solved in medical training. It's difficult, I think, for educators to teach how to be in the middle of that tension. You've done an amazing job at doing so. And that's just one of many challenges that face health professionals today. Maybe you can let us know what do you think are some of the other greatest challenges that health professionals face in terms of their ability to work with energy, compassion, commitment, robustness, attention, all the things that you've spoken about in the past.
Yeah, I want to start with my own personal experience of going through training and the early years of my career. I felt very much as an outsider, and I had really good friends in medical school, but they were also kind of at the periphery of medical culture. And fortunately, I had enough of a life outside of medicine, mostly with musicians, that I had a good set of friends and support network. But I felt that within medicine, I just didn't fit. I've subsequently learned that probably a real lot of people in medicine don't feel like they fit. And it may even be the majority. which is kind of a problem, isn't it? Because the majority of us, I think, went into medicine for exactly the right reasons, that they wanted to help patients grow and flourish and live lives that they find meaningful, and also that they themselves wanted to draw meaning and a sense of purpose from their own work. And yet the system is set up to undermine that in so many ways. And there are all sorts of words that we use to describe ourselves or that are used towards us that I think are kind of hurtful, like don't be over-involved, emotions aren't good, you don't have time for this, it's not going to be, you know, it's not, you can't bill for this, you can't. And those messages are, you know, are pervasive and, if anything, getting worse. And so that disconnect between who I am as a person and this rather toxic world that I inhabit is really, really striking. And I'm just trying to put words to what the missing ingredient is. I think there's a real difference between taking care of patients and caring for patients, okay, and caring about patients. And you know, this goes back to Francis Peabody's, you know, famous lecture in 1927, and many people have said it in different ways. But I think the thing that's being erased in our healthcare system is this capacity to care about one another. And caring means not following rules when the rules are inadequate. Caring means making yourself vulnerable in a certain way to help others. I think on an individual level, on a person-to-person level, that is rewarded. So most of my colleagues, when they go beyond the call of duty, you know, I say thank you, and they say thank you to me when I do that. And those relationships are really, really important. But I have a sense that the institutions, and it's not even, you know, sometimes individuals at the top, but just institutional culture doesn't recognize that. And they pile more stuff that's meaningless on us. And there's this schism between what we see ourselves doing and what really matters just gets too great. Now, we all find different ways of addressing that. So as an educator, I'm very clear with a student who's rotating with me on a rotation that I'm interested in their personal experience of being a healer, and not just whether they get the diagnosis right or choose the right treatment or even communicate well with a patient. All those are important. But I'll say my fundamental interest is that you become the healer that you can, that only you can be. I don't want you to copy what I'm doing. You might learn some things, but the long-term goal is that you need to find those things that you say and do and believe that are going to give you a sustainable sense of purpose and meaning. And so part of our work together, even if we're just on a two-week rotation together, is to look at that as well as all these other skills that you have. I've yet to meet a student who hasn't reacted well to this. And also, you know, what they'll say at the end of the rotation or in their evaluations was, I wish there were more of that in medical education. So I think the structure of medical education is too fragmented. There's no sense that there's one person who's got personal responsibility for you, your own growth, throughout the 4 years. And there are different programs that, including at our medical school, which are very good advising and coaching programs. But I think that those longitudinal relationships really should need to be more at the core.
I'd like to take a closer look, if we can, at two words, joy and meaning. And if you could just talk a little bit about the importance, if you think it's important, because it's also reasonable thing to ask a question whether it is important, joy and meaning for the health professional, for the physician. If you could just talk a little bit about that, the importance of that and why.
I do. I just want to kind of take apart the word joy, because it means different things to different people. And for me, it's the part of joy that implies fulfillment, a sense of wholeness. And so when I walk out of one of those contentious family meetings on the palliative care service, you know, it's not the jump for joy kind of joy, but I feel that I feel a sense of deep fulfillment that, and also the word meaning, it's nothing that's hidden. You know, it's nothing that's to be discovered. Meaning is right there. You know, meaning is in the action. It's not a result of it. So I see them as kind of confluent, and that sense of fulfillment and that sense of meaning, you know, they're part of the same thought.
Why should say the general public be concerned about us finding meaning and joy in our work? I guess another way of putting that is what is it like to be a patient of someone who isn't aligned in that way, and what's the alternative experience like to be aligned with that importance, and is that relevant to patient care and outcomes?
I'll tell you from the perspective of a patient. I had to have surgery last spring. And when I first met the surgeon, he was really preoccupied with electronic health record and barely looked at me and hadn't remembered that we had met 3 years previously about a similar issue. After the surgery, he looked me in the eye and described some of the procedures he had to do. As he said, you know, I know this is going to be the recovery will be a little rough for a few days. It's almost inhumane, but you will feel better after a period of time. And just the fact that he was able to resonate with that feeling of utter helplessness and vulnerability and pain and discomfort and all of that. And, you know, he's not a warm, fuzzy person, but it was very clear to me that he truly understood and was present with what I was experiencing. And so that contrast, just even within an individual and context, I suspect that that first encounter we had was joyless for him and not very present for me. And I think with the second encounter, the surgery for him actually was challenging. It had some, there were some things that were, that, so I think for him, he, that sense of connection reflected his sense of connection, probably with the technical part of his work, but also with the human part of the work. And I felt that. Mm. I felt that really clearly. And, you know, my wife is a professional musician, and she talks about gigs that she goes on where everyone is really there, and then there, or other gigs that she's working where there are musicians who are just phoning it in. You know, they're just kind of playing along mechanically, doing their job, but there's no, they're elsewhere. You know, they're, and patients can tell if you're phoning it in a nanosecond. So the joy part, the flourishing part, the engagement part, you know, whatever word you want to use, the connection part, it's pheromones. It is the way you smile, you know, if it's a sincere smile as opposed to a forced smile. And we have to pick up on that quickly because, you know, that's how we tell whether someone's friendly or dangerous or both. Right. And so I think it's integral that now I think I want to separate this from, if you think about joy as, you know, having lots of things and going on expensive vacations and belonging to golf clubs and, you know, whatever, that's not the joy I'm talking about. And so the public should care less about that kind of stuff, but about having a doctor who's really flourishing, engaged, joyous and present about the work that they're doing. That's what you look for.
Yes, I would agree 100%. So, you know, talking about joy, was a joy when your book, Attending Medicine, Mindfulness and Humanity, really the first book about mindfulness and medical practice was published, and reading it, it was joy to read it. In your book, you describe in the final chapter imagining a mindful healthcare system. And I know the book was published 7 years ago. It's been a while. But describe, if you can, two things and sort of a little bit imagine journey for you. The first, your experience as a patient in an encounter, and you can choose any kind of encounter, within an imaginary healthcare system that was a mindful healthcare system, as you described in that chapter. Secondly, describe what it would be like to be a physician working in that same setting in that imaginary mindful healthcare system? And then third, I guess, what are some of the ways, the work we have to do to get there?
Okay, yeah. Wow. As a patient, I think that that sense that even though clock time is limited, that this presence that I experience with a clinician is timeless, that time stands still. And we know that patients who really feel listened to also think that their visits with their doctor are longer. The psychological time is longer. So that sense of timelessness, that sense of really being listened to, the sense that you're not put in a category, that you're being treated as a unique individual. And I'll put along with that a sense of confidence that this other person, that this doctor knows what they're doing. Okay. So I don't want just someone who's a good talker and really friendly. I want someone who knows their stuff, right? And how you communicate that, you can communicate that in many ways, but trying to be arrogant and self-aggrandizing is not one of them. So a certain dose of humility. As a physician, I would want that everything that led up to the patient walking into the door, into my walking into the door of the examining room, would put them in a receptive, relaxed, and fully aware state of being. I know that's asking a lot, but whatever happens before you go into the room makes you feel that you can be the person that you are and that you'll be accepted for who you are, and that the doctor's interest in you is a genuine one. Now, you know, obviously, you know, we see lots and lots of patients. We can't be intimate in the same way with all the patients we see, but you can have a genuine interest in each person as a human being and recognize their uniqueness. And then everything that happens after the visit reinforces the things that are the most important. Our chart notes in this country are 8 times as long as the chart notes in any other country in the world. And all of it is because of regulatory stuff, right? Insurance companies, government, what have you. And in the UK, if a child has a sore throat, your note is 2 lines, sore throat, no fever, no adenopathy, you know, follow up in a week or whatever it is. Here it's 8 pages. So that kind of regulatory stuff that we have to deal with does not enhance anything that's important in medicine. And most of it can be dispensed with no harm to anybody. Just a little example. So making communication among clinicians easier. You know, you should have a sense that if you're seeing more than one doctor, that they're actually able to communicate with one another. And my experience with relatives in other parts of the country trying to get medical care, it's horrendous, you know. And to think about, just to ask oneself, and even ask, you know, people who are non-clinicians but are healthcare administrators, what is the most important thing? What is the most important thing in healthcare? And if people could actually have that question in front of them and direct their efforts towards the most important thing, rather than, oh, I have to do this or I have to do that. I mean, it's probably good advice for life in general. But be given that healthcare is in such a mess, I think we need to do that in a very conscious and deliberate way. Now, all the details of the pathways to get there and who pays for what and, you know, who's responsible for what, that gets complicated. But I think that needs to be the starting point.
We're almost finished. I just have 2 somewhat related questions. I guess they're related just to finish up. And then if there's anything else you'd like to add, you know, you have a great deal of experience in sharing and motivating and inspiring other health professionals and physicians in particular to take a look at some of these issues, to really think about what the most important thing is. What, if you were to sum it up in some recommendations, either general or even specific, to those whom you identify as your fellow health professionals, what would you offer here on this podcast to them just as a take home? And then a related question, or actually request, is describe to us something that we've brought into our mindful practice training together which is a practice called 90 seconds for the patient. If you could just describe that as something people can take home with them.
First of all, I want to say that mindfulness is not something you do sitting on a cushion or going to a retreat center. Mindfulness is how you live your life. And when we talk about mindful practice for health professionals, we're talking about how you live your life as a health professional. So where can you, but I think that we also need reminders. And so, to quote a Zen teacher, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. So part of the problem is remembering. Okay. So for me, when I was in the depths of despair about the new electronic health record system a few years ago, a patient of mine said to me, I'd known him for quite some time, you know, part of why I really like you as a doctor is that you really take time to listen and I really feel understood. But ever since you got this new computer system, I feel like, you know, you've been really distracted by that. And I mean, he had a tremendous amount of courage to say that. And I just, it stopped me dead in my tracks. And I said, you know, you are absolutely right that this is not good for me, nor is it good for patients. And I thanked him. Although for me, it kind of felt like someone just, you know, stuck a dagger through my heart. You know, it just was because this is what I aspired to do, was to be present. And he was saying, no, you're not. So I just decided, it just popped into my head, you know, saying, well, what can I do to make sure that I'm actually present and listening? So I just decided for every patient, for the first 90 seconds of a visit, I wouldn't open the electronic chart. I wouldn't have any notes. I would just sit there and talk with the patient, say, why are you here? What's going on? What's happened since last time? What's most important for you to talk about today? And just listen. And just listen. You know, ask maybe a few clarifying questions. I didn't quite understand what you said, or could you say a little bit more about that? But just listen. So I would suggest trying that. See what it does for you. If 90 seconds seems really difficult, start with 30. Okay. But see what that does, you know, to your practice. See what it does to the way you feel at the end of the day. See if it makes your day any longer. It might even shorten your day. It for me, it actually had no effect on when I got home at night. But for me, it gave me a greater sense of connection to the things that were the most important. The other thing is to think about transitions. So when you're going from one room to the next, or one meeting to the next, or one patient to the next, what can you do during that transition time? So if it involves a walk, can you walk and just notice your surroundings? And maybe even notice something that's beautiful, even if it's a sterile hospital environment. There might be one thing that's beautiful. Or when you're about to enter a room, just stop and take a breath and just be aware of the thoughts and feelings you're carrying with you and make a decision about which ones you really need to carry with you into that room and which ones you don't. Not that you're saying they're not worth thinking about or feeling, but you know, what's most important right now? And so those are just two things. I mean, clearly we have to fix the system, but the system's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be anywhere near perfect. And so I feel like we all, to some extent, need to take some responsibility for our own sustainability, mostly because no one else will. I mean, it's kind of a harsh reality. Others can help, they can support us, but I think fundamentally that we need to find some way of finding connection and meaning.
Well, that's great. You know, I want to, again, thank you so much for being interviewed or being on this podcast. And also, what's really wonderful is, you know, we spent a lot of time together teaching. We go to meetings together, planning. But this was just such a lovely way for me to get to know a little bit more about you, things that I didn't really know. And I think the listeners will also appreciate learning about you as a person and really as a force in helping physicians and other health professionals flourish. So thanks.
Thanks for listening. We will include a summary of today's podcast and some links to Dr. Epstein and other references that were discussed in the show notes. I'd like to conclude today's podcast, as I conclude each podcast, with a practical exercise to help you flourish during your workday. The intention is for you to develop a toolbox of skills that you can draw upon to enhance purpose, meaning, and well-being. Ron spoke of 90 seconds for the patient, This is a practice for those of you who are engaged in clinical care to use at the onset of an encounter. As he said, perhaps begin with 30 seconds or 60 seconds, and as we advise in medicine, increase as tolerated. Another brief practice to do is a hand washing practice. Everyone involved in clinical care washes their hands many times daily. It's not trivial. In fact, it's an important aspect of our work. Developing a habit of intentionality and presence can help the effectiveness of hand washing, at the same time cultivate presence. So let's talk about how you would do this. You begin washing your hands, turn on the water, you put some soap, either liquid or bar soap, into your hands, and you begin to wash the hands, paying attention to what it feels like to have the water touch the hands, what it feels like to have the soap on the hands, what it feels like for you to spread the soap and the water around the hands, the palms, the backs of the hands, each finger, doing so with awareness, with the knowledge that this is an important part of the practice, that you are actually taking care of yourself and taking care of others in the process of washing your hands. Be fully with the practice for as long as it takes. 20, 30, 60 seconds of hand washing can be a very effective way of decreasing the amount of germs on the hands and making your ability to work with patients more healthy. As you conclude the washing of the hands, rinsing the fingers off, shaking the hands, and then taking whatever material you use to dry the hands or an automatic air blowing dryer, and noticing again the contact of the air, of the cloth, of the paper with the hands as you dry the hands. This can be done many times a day, and the more attention we give to this, the better the outcomes of our hand washing is, and also the ability to be present with it, to use it as a way of dropping into this present moment, to what you are actually doing at this moment. One more thing I would like to share before we close is a poem I heard recently while listening to an interview by Tim Ferriss with the meditation teacher Jack Kornfeld. Jack shared a poem by Jack Gilbert about a brief for the defense. Actually, the title of the poem is called A Brief for the Defense. Ron spoke early on in the podcast about joy in medicine in the midst of the contradictions and how joy is important for health professionals. I agree that our joy as health professionals is important, and I hope you find joy in listening to this poem. So here it is, A Brief for the Defense by Jack Gilbert. Sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness in their future, smiling and laughing while somebody in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages of Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit there will be music despite everything. We stand at the prow again of a small ship anchored late at night in the tiny port, looking over to the sleeping island. The waterfront is three shuttered cafes and one naked light burning. To hear the faint sound of oars in the silence as a rowboat comes slowly out and then goes back is truly worth all the years of sorrow that are to come. I hope you have found this podcast, the simple exercises, and this poem useful to you, and look forward to having you join us for our next episode of Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. For more information about MPRO, please visit www.myempro.com. For more information about me and my work, please visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.